Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 460, titled War Emblem. This is being recorded on May 10th of the year 2004. What we're going to be dealing with is a subject that I touched on very, very briefly in some of the programs done in the spring of the year 2002. At the time, I noted that it was brutally ironic that a member of the Saudi royal family was the owner of the horse named War Emblem, and that that horse had won not only the Kentucky Derby but the Preakness Stakes, two of the three legs of horse racing's famed Triple Crown. Ultimately, War Emblem did not win the Belmont Stakes, but I noted that with the profound evidence already very concrete by the spring of 2002, that some of the Bush family's Saudi business associates and political co-conspirators were implicated in the funding of Al-Qaeda. It was very ironic to have a member of the Saudi royal family owning a horse titled War Emblem that was winning horse races and achieving fame as well as money for its owner here in the United States. In For the Record 459, which listeners have just heard, we read an excerpt from a posting on the brilliant Peter Dale Scott's website, and that concerned Prince Ahmad bin Salman bin Abdulaziz, the owner of the Kentucky Derby winner War Emblem. What we're going to look at next is an excerpt from the book House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger. This book goes into the flying of prominent Saudis out of the United States in the wake of September 11th. As we've noted in a number of programs, the flights out of the United States, many of them at a time when no civilians could fly, not only carried prominent members of the Saudi royal family, who were not only involved with the Bush family in a big way in business, but who have also been involved with the Bush family in past covert operations, ranging from the BCCI, the funding of the Contras, the funding of the Afghan Mujahideen, and other conspiracies. Members of the Saudi royal family and members of the bin Laden family that also had business connections to the Bushes were flown out of the United States. At least two members of the bin Laden family, Abdullah and Khalil, also Omar bin Laden, who were flown out of the U.S., have been implicated in terrorist-related activities, specifically in connection with Al-Qaeda. And we've talked about that in numerous broadcasts. For the Record, 423, 425, and 454 go into those connections at considerable length and in detail. By the way, let me remind you that in addition to the fact that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, there are also detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. For those members of the listening audience who only utilize the on-air broadcast, please get in the habit of using the descriptions. The program itself is inextricably linked with the print medium. I do these programs and use the pedantic format that I use specifically so the programs can be taped. I do this program so that it can be taped. But also with the advent of the Internet, now there are very, very long descriptions in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And often there is text and material in the descriptions that I simply did not have time to put in the original broadcast. So for those listeners who want to have some hard copy, who want something in print, I have been slaving away at writing and editing those descriptions myself for a number of years. Please take advantage of that. They're available, they're free, and they are copious in nature. Now, once again, vis-a-vis the flights out of the United States in the wake of September 11th, some of these flights conducted at a time when no other civilians could fly, these flights carried members of the Saudi royal family, which, as indicated in, indicated in many things, including the book we're about to excerpt, The House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger. The Saudi royal family and the very closely connected bin Laden family have profound business connections to the Bush family. At the end of For the Record 459, we discussed the elder George Bush at the annual investor conference in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel of the Carlyle Group. That was on September 11th of 2001. He was winging his way out of Washington as the hijacked plane was winging its way in. The elder George Bush has been in some interesting places. Watch where he flies, because he's in interesting places at interesting times. Flying out of Washington on September 11th as the hijacked aircraft were getting ready to fly in. He was flying into Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, as President Kennedy's body was being flown out. I think those two bits of air travel by the elder George Bush serve as something of symbolic bookends, and perhaps far more than just symbolic bookends, to some very tragic, a very tragic period in American history, to be followed, I suspect, by an even more tragic period in American history. But we're going to be looking at War Emblem and its owner. Again, in the spring of 2002, I noted how ironic it was that a member of the Saudi royal family would own a horse named War Emblem that would win two-thirds of racing's famed Triple Crown in the United States. It appears that War Emblem was a far more ironic name than I had been aware of at the time, because it looks like Prince Salman was in, or Prince Ahmed bin Salman, was in fact one of the contact points between the Saudi royal family and Al-Qaeda. We're going to talk about that right now. This is from the book, just out, House of Bush, House of Saud, by Craig Unger, published in hardcover by Scribner's and copyright 2004. Speaking of the decision to allow key members of the Saudi royal family and the bin Laden family to leave the United States before they could be interrogated, we read in House of Bush, House of Saud, just how wrong this decision was became apparent several months later when the war in Afghanistan was in full swing. On Thursday, March 28, 2002, acting on electronic intercepts of telephone calls, heavily armed Pakistani commando units accompanied by American Special Forces and FBI SWAT teams raided a two-story house in the suburbs of Faisalabad in western Pakistan. They had received tips that one of the people in the house was Abu Zubaydah, the 30-year-old chief of operations for Al-Qaeda, who had been the head of field operations for the USS Cole bombing and who was also a close confidant of Osama bin Laden's. 2 days later, on March 30th, news of Zubaydah's capture was spreading all over the world. At first, the administration refused to corroborate the reports. Then it celebrated the capture of the highest-ranking Al-Qaeda operative ever to be taken into custody. Quote, "This represents a very significant blow to Al-Qaeda," unquote, said White House spokesman Ari Fleischer. He called Zubaydah, quote, "a key terrorist recruiter, an operational planner, and a member of Osama bin Laden's inner circle," unquote. Donald Rumsfeld told a news conference that Zubaydah was, quote, "being given exactly the," beginning again, Donald Rumsfeld told a news conference that Zubaydah was, quote, "being given exactly the excellent medical care one would want if they wanted to make sure he was around a good long time to visit with us," unquote. The international media speculated as to what Zubaydah might know and what he might say. On Sunday, March 31st, 3 days after the raid, the interrogation began. By the way, it's interesting to note the timeline on this. This was right after the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002, which busted the Al-Qaeda funding structure in the United States. And that Al-Qaeda funding structure overlapped not only the GOP, but the Bush administration and people connected to George Bush socially, politically, and in business. One wonders to what extent some of the disclosures that were coming out from Zubaydah might have become known to some of these people. It was 4 days later, on April 4th of 2002, that Talat Otman interceded with George Bush on behalf of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids. Again, people who were allegedly funding Al-Qaeda as well as Hamas and who overlapped the GOP. Paul O'Neill was dismissed as Secretary of the Treasury. Some months later, the raids, the Operation Green Quest raids of 3/20 of 2002, took place under the auspices of the Treasury Department. And since that time, the Operation Green Quest raids have been frustrated by the transferring of the responsibility for the investigation from Treasury to the FBI, where Robert Mueller, an individual who has proved less than vigorous in his investigations of criminal activity connected to the Bush administration, such as the BCCI case, Robert Mueller rules the roost at the FBI. And so the timeline here is very interesting, because Abu Zubaydah was spilling some very, very interesting beans here at the same time period that the Operation Green Quest raids had taken place. And this is the time period in which Talat Otman, director of Harkin Energy, associate of the Bushes, was interceding on behalf of the targets of the Green Quest raids. Returning once again to House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger. The international media speculated as to what Zubaydah might know and what he might say. On Sunday, March 31st, 3 days after the raid, the interrogation began. Speaking of the interrogators, who used unusual methods for the interrogation, first, they administered thiopental sodium, better known under its trademark name sodium pentothal, through an IV drip to make Zubaydah more talkative. Since the prisoner had been shot 3 times during the capture, he was already hooked up to a drip to treat his wounds, and it was possible to administer the drug without his knowledge. Second, as a variation on the good cop, bad cop routine, the CIA used 2 teams of debriefers. One consisted of undisguised Americans who were at least willing to treat Zubaydah's injuries while they interrogated him. The other team consisted of Arab Americans posing as Saudi security agents who were known for their brutal interrogation techniques. The thinking was that Zubaydah would be so scared of being turned over to the Saudis, ever infamous for their public executions in Riyadh's Chop Chop Square, that he would try to win over the American interrogators by talking to them. In fact, exactly the opposite happened. When Zubaydah was confronted with men passing themselves off as Saudi security officers, his reaction was not fear, but instead relief. The prisoner, who had been reluctant even to confirm his identity to his American captors, suddenly started talking animatedly. He was happy to see them, he said, because he feared the Americans would torture and then kill him. Zubaydah asked his interrogators to call a senior member of the ruling Saudi family. He then provided a private home number and cell phone number from memory. Quote, "He will tell you what to do," Zubaydah promised them. The name Zubaydah gave came as a complete surprise to the CIA. It was Prince Ahmed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz, the owner of many legendary racehorses and one of the most westernized members of the royal family. On September 16th, 2001, Prince Ahmed, of course, had boarded the flight in Lexington as part of the evacuation plan approved by the Bush White House. Prince Ahmed was well known not just in Saudi Arabia, but also in publishing circles in London and horse racing circles in Kentucky. He was such an unlikely name that the interrogators immediately assumed that Zubaydah was lying to buy time. The interrogators then kept their prisoner on a, quote, bare minimum of pain medication and interrupted his sleep with bright lights for hour after hour before restarting the sodium pentothal drip. When they returned, Zubaydah spoke to his faux Saudi interrogators as if they, not he, were the ones in trouble. He said that several years earlier, the royal family had made a deal with Al-Qaeda in which the House of Saud would aid the Taliban so long as Al-Qaeda kept terrorism out of Saudi Arabia. Zubaydah added that as part of this arrangement, he dealt with Prince Ahmed and 2 other members of the House of Saud as intermediaries, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki al-Saud, a nephew of King Fahd, and Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud al-Kabir, a 25-year-old distant relative of the king's. Again, he furnished phone numbers from memory. The interrogators responded by telling Zubaydah that 9/11 had changed everything. The House of Saud certainly would not stand behind him after that. It was then that Zubaydah dropped his real bombshell. Zubaydah said that 9/11 changed nothing because Ahmed knew beforehand that an attack was scheduled for American soil that day. They just didn't know what it would be, nor did they want to know more than that. That the information had been passed to them, said Zubaydah, because bin Laden knew they could not stop it without knowing the specifics, but later they would be hard-pressed to turn on him if he could disclose their foreknowledge, unquote. 2 weeks later, Zubaydah was moved to an undisclosed location. When he figured out that the interrogators were really Americans, not Saudis, he allegedly tried to strangle himself and later recanted his entire tale. As this book went to press, no one had convincingly refuted this account. Meanwhile, the subject of Zubaydah's story, Prince Ahmed, had very different concerns on his mind: horse racing. The previous year, Ahmed had experienced extraordinary success with his 3-year-old colt, Point Given. Ahmed had been devastated when Point Given came in 5th in the Kentucky Derby. In early April of 2002, while Zubaydah was still being interrogated, Prince Ahmed, knowing he didn't have a horse for the Kentucky Derby, was watching satellite TV in Riyadh when he saw a War Emblem win the Illinois Derby by 6 lengths. Quote, "I was very impressed, so we got the door open, got the horse for a reasonable price, and we go for it," unquote, the prince told a New York Times sports reporter. "We were thinking Derby," unquote. And why wasn't the CIA thinking Prince Ahmed, who was due to return to the United States for the Derby? Allegedly, senior CIA officials had ordered a thorough investigation to see whether there was any truth to the assertions Zubaydah had made during his interrogation. About a month afterward, they issued a report that corroborated some statements he had made, but that was largely inconclusive. Then they quietly approached Saudi intelligence to ask whether Prince Ahmed could have been an al-Qaeda contact. The Saudis assured them that could not possibly be the case. That left the administration with nowhere to go unless it wanted to create an international incident. And so, on May 7, 2002, Prince Ahmed's war emblem entered the Kentucky Derby as a 20-to-1 shot. It was a gorgeous day at Churchill Downs Racetrack in Louisville. 8 months after 9/11, however, America was still in mourning, and at 5:15 p.m., about 50 minutes before the race, a trumpet played taps, and the crowd of 145,000 attending the country's premier horse racing event fell silent. Firefighters from New York City's Ladder Company 3 on East 29th Street were the guests of honor, standing at attention in front of the winner's circle. 12 members of the company had lost their lives in the World Trade Center attack. Post time was 6:04. War Emblem had the number 5 position in the wide-open, 19-horse field with no strong favorite. Before the gun, the trainer gave jockey Victor Espinoza his instructions. "Sit still. This horse likes a quiet jockey." Quote, "I've never seen this horse before," Espinoza said. "Just don't move until the last minute," he told me, probably 100 times. Finally, I listened to him, unquote. War Emblem broke cleanly at the gate and took the lead in front of Proud Citizen, and that was it. He pulled away at mid-stretch, holding the lead wire to wire, winning by 4 lengths. A few people jeered as Prince Ahmed made his way to the winner's circle, but that didn't seem to bother him. Quote, "Everyone respects me here," he said. "Everybody actually makes me feel so good sometimes I'm embarrassed. The American public treats me better than in Saudi Arabia," unquote. "It's a great achievement," he added. "This was important for me, and it's an honor to be the first Arab to win the Kentucky Derby," unquote. Columnist Jimmy Breslin, covering the Derby for Newsday, did not fail to notice Prince Ahmed's self-satisfaction. Quote, "Prince Ahmed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia held up the winner's cup and gloated with the thought of the million and more he had made with the win, and did this in the presence of firefighters from Ladder 3, unquote, Breslin wrote, again quoting, "I wondered right away if Prince Ahmed had done anything to let us know he was sorry, and could he do anything to assist after what bin Laden and other homegrown degenerates did to this city, but the guy did nothing. What are you bothering me for?" the prince said in Louisville. "I am in horse racing, not politics," unquote. 2 weeks later, War Emblem won the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore. Prince Ahmed's colt now had a long shot at being the first Triple Crown winner since Seattle Slew in 1977. After the war, a reporter asked Ahmed how much he wanted to win the Triple Crown. Quote, "As badly as I wanted my son and daughter to get married," he replied, again quoting, "really bad. To win the Triple Crown would really knock me out," unquote. But on June 8th, Prince Ahmed did not even show up at the Belmont Stakes, the third part of the Triple Crown. "I'm disappointed the prince wasn't here," said trainer Bob Baffert. Ahmed was said to be tending to family obligations in Riyadh. An associate said that he did not know the nature of the obligations. In any case, War Emblem stumbled as he came out of the starting gate and came in eighth. About 6 weeks later, on July 22nd, Prince Ahmed was dead. News reports said the 43-year-old nephew of King Fahd had died in his sleep due to a heart attack. Ahmed was not the only person named by Zubaydah to suffer ill. The next day, July 23rd, Ahmed's cousin, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud, was killed in a one-car crash while en route to Ahmed's funeral. A week later, on July 30th, Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud Al Kabir, a third member of the royal family who had been named by Zubaydah, was found in the desert, apparently having died of thirst. In and of themselves, the three mysterious deaths do not conclusively confirm the assertion that Zubaydah was telling the truth about Osama bin Laden and his high-level links to the House of Saud. Now, of course, the three men cannot be interviewed. Not that the FBI didn't have its chance at one of them. On September 16, 2001, after the Bush administration had approved the Saudi evacuation, Prince Ahmed boarded the 727 in Lexington, Kentucky. He had been identified by FBI officials, but not seriously interrogated. It was an inauspicious start to the just-declared war on terror. Quote, "What happened on September 11th was a horrific crime," unquote, says John Martin, a former Justice Department official, again quoting, "It was an act of war. And the answer is, no, this is not any way to go about investigating it," unquote. As for the Saudis, they were not offering any answers. On September 4th, 2003, roughly 2 years after September 11th, Saudi embassy spokesman Nail Al-Jubair appeared on CNN and was asked by newscaster Paul Azan, quote, "Can you tell us unequivocally tonight that no one on board those planes had anything to do with either the planning or the execution of the September 11th plot?" Quote, "There are only two things that I'm sure about," Al-Jubair replied. Quote, "That there is the existence of God, and then we will die at the end of the world. Everything else, we don't know," unquote. And in addition to the deaths of the three members of the Saudi royal family allegedly named by Abu Zubaydah, there was another very, very interesting death, and that's talked about in a footnote here by Craig Unger. Nor was that the end of it. During his interrogation, Abu Zubaydah had allegedly also said that Osama bin Laden had struck a deal with Pakistani Air Force Chief Air Marshal Mushaf Ali Mir and had told him there would be unspecified attacks on American soil on September 11th. 7 months after the Saudi deaths on February 20th of 2003, Mir and 16 others were killed when their plane crashed in a northwest province of Pakistan. Sabotage was widely speculated to be behind the crash, but could not be proved. So, again, summing up some of what we've looked at here, it is alleged in the material carried in Craig Unger's book that in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, conducted under sodium pentothal and with two teams of CIA interrogators, one being what they were, in fact, CIA, the other posing as Saudi interrogators, Abu Zubaydah made some interesting disclosures. The thinking had been that because of the Saudi intelligence services and law enforcement services' notorious reputation for torturing suspects, that Abu Zubaydah would be horrified at the presence of Saudi interrogators and would willingly and readily roll over to the CIA. But in fact, according to the material here, the opposite was allegedly the case, and it is alleged that Abu Zubaydah, in fact, had willingly talked to the people he considered to be Saudis and told them to contact some members of the Saudi royal family, and specifically Prince Ahmed's cousin, as well as Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud and Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud Al Kabir, three members of the Saudi royal family. Now, on July 22nd of 2002, with the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah having taken place on March 31st, Prince Ahmed dies at the age of 43, allegedly of a heart attack. The next day, July 23rd, his cousin, Prince Sultan bin Faisal bin Turki Al Saud, was killed in a one-car automobile accident while on the way to Prince Ahmed's funeral. And it should be noted that Prince Sultan bin Faisal was only 41. Then, a week later, on July 30th, Prince Fahd bin Turki bin Saud al-Kabir, a third member of the royal family, was found in the desert, apparently having died of thirst. Well, one can't imagine why a member of the Saudi royal family would not anticipate bringing water out in the middle of the desert. Again, that's rather strange. And now, again, note that allegedly, Abu Zubaydah also disclosed that Osama bin Laden had struck a deal with the Pakistani Air Force Chief Air Marshal Mushaf Ali Mir. And repeating from the footnote that we read earlier, during his interrogation, Zubaydah had also said that Osama bin Laden had struck a deal with Pakistani Air Force Chief Air Marshal Mushaf Ali Mir and had told him that there would be unspecified attacks on American soil on September 11th. 7 months after the Saudi deaths on February 20th, 2003, Mir and 16 others were killed when their plane crashed in a northwest province of Pakistan. Sabotage was widely speculated to be behind the crash, but could not be proved. It's also interesting to ruminate about what possible technical and logistical assistance the hijackers and Al-Qaeda might have received from the chief of the Pakistani Air Force, alleged here to have been a collaborator of Osama bin Laden's. And again, some of the unresolved questions about air traffic might have something to do with that. Certainly, the chief of the Pakistani Air Force would have been in a position to provide some pretty concrete technical assistance and or advice to people who were planning on hijacking airliners. But simply from an actuarial standpoint, the notion that Prince Ahmed would die at the age of 43, that his cousin at the age of 41 would then be killed in an automobile accident, that a 25-year-old cousin would then be found in the desert, dead of thirst a week later, and that in early 2003, yet another person named as an alleged collaborator of Osama bin Laden would have died in an airplane crash. The notion that this would simply be coincidence is a bit much to imagine. From an actuarial standpoint, it is extremely unlikely that this would be coincidence. Again, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on Real Audio at a longer address connected both to the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Spitfire is the CD and tape duplication service that carries all of the programs and lectures I've done over the years. You can reach them by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. You can reach them by email at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Again, Spitfire List is one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T .com. And there are descriptions of all of the programs I've done over the years. And again, from, I think, FTR 233 on, I've been doing detailed, annotated, article-length descriptions. So for listeners that have only been listening on the air, please take advantage of the Spitfire website. There is a wealth of printed information available for people who want to pursue this material at greater length. Note that the Spitfire website is now equipped with a search function so that people can locate particular items. Note also that the landmark text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile is now available for download for free on the Spitfire website. Part of the book is now in HTML. The rest eventually will be in HTML to save bandwidth. The rest is, at least for the time being, in Adobe Acrobat. This concludes For the Record, program number 460, War Emblem, being recorded on May 10th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.